Welcome to the Tactical Breakdown. A podcast for law enforcement, military, and emergency response professionals.
Stand by.
Where we help you bridge the gap and talk training, tactics, and leadership with the best subject matter experts in the world. Checking in with you every week to deliver actionable intelligence and bring important resources and information to the men and women who serve. Here is your host, Adam Kanakin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Tactical Breakdown Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Kanakin. My guest today is Dr. Mike Simpson. Mike is the host of the Mind of the Warrior podcast and is a board-certified emergency medical physician. Our talk is going to be all about tactical medicine. We're going to talk about TCCC, care under fire, tactical field care. We're going to talk about self-care, current training and equipment, things that guys are doing in the field right now, talking about IFACs, talking about kit. There's going to be so much stuff in this podcast. I'm so excited to get it to you. So let's jump right into it and get Doc on the line. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. I'm glad we could finally hammer some time down and get a chance to speak. There's a lot of things that I wanted to ask you because of your area of expertise. So before we jump into all of that, why don't you let the listeners know kind of who you are and what you do?
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here, Adam. Thanks so much for having me. My name is Mike Simpson. I'm a doctor of emergency medicine practicing down here in the great state of Texas. I retired from the United States Army in 2016. I'm currently practicing doing what we call locums work. So I don't work at any one particular hospital. I kind of jump around. And I'm also medical director for a company called Persis Medical that makes the Israeli bandage, the next generation interosseous needle, and a lot of really cool cutting edge pre-hospital stuff.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was super excited when we started talking offline a bit about exactly what you're doing right now. But to tie into the reason why I got you on the podcast in the first place was kind of more so your background and what you've done throughout your whole life. And I'm not going to kind of wreck it. I'm going to let you tell your story a little bit. So why don't you tell us about your time when you started, from when you started with the military until now?
Sure. So I 2 weeks out of high school, I raised my right hand and I shipped off to the United States Army. We went to infantry basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, and my first unit of assignment was the 1st Ranger Battalion in Savannah, Georgia. I spent 4 years there as an infantryman, specifically as a recoilless rifle squad member, then gunner, then ultimately section leader. Thought that I actually was going to get out and pursue a career in law enforcement. And so I finished after my first enlistment, and I was doing some college courses, kind of waiting around to see if the right job was going to open up. Again, kind of dabbling in college, I had thoughts of maybe getting a degree and either doing DEA or Secret Service or something like that. And the first Gulf War kicked off and the National Guard unit I was in got mobilized and realized that I really missed being on active duty. So I stayed around after going to Special Forces selection. I was in an SF Guard unit, went to the 18 Charlie course, which is a Special Forces demolition sergeant, did that job for a few years on active duty in the 7th Special Forces group. Got bored with that, saw another shiny object, decided to pursue that and be an 18 Delta Special Forces medic, and did that. Absolutely loved it. That was my job for most of my time on an operational detachment. Ultimately did a couple deployments as a team sergeant and also as an intelligence sergeant before going to medical school, which was the next shiny object that popped up. And went to medical school, went to emergency medicine residency. While in emergency medicine residency, I got a phone call and I was selected for the Joint Special Operations Command for a special mission unit specifically that provides medical care. So did that for 6 years while practicing as an emergency medicine physician, and then retired out of Fort Hood, Texas, and retired down here to Texas, which is my home and where my kids are.
Whew, that's quite the story, man. The I was telling you before, the fact that you went from started, you know, as an infantryman all the way up to now being a medical doctor and in the position that you are, kind of overseeing a lot of different things, especially medical advancements in the field. That's an amazing story. And I'm really glad that you were able to join us today. One of the funny things was when I was looking at everything from your career and your accomplishments and the amount of knowledge that you have, when I became a, this is going to sound really funny after listening to your story, but I became a first aid instructor a couple years ago here, and it kind of just parried into some of the defensive tactics training stuff. And I never really, I ran one or two courses and I never really did it. And when people are asking me why I never did it, I always said, because I'm not the expert, you know, like, yes, I can teach it. Yes, I know it. But outside of the textbook, I mean, and, you know, and the handful of times that I've actually had to use an AED and do chest compression and those types of things, I don't do that. So every time that there was ever a reason to run a course, I don't track down the guys that teach first aid, but they're active paramedics, guys that have been
right
for the last 15, 20 years, because they do it day in, day out. They know it back to front, and they know all the intricacies that they're never going to get from somebody like myself, which is one why I was so excited to have you on, because you don't only talk the talk, man. You've walked the walk. You've been on deployments. You're an active ER doctor. So I know that everybody listening here is going to be kind of on the edge of their seat when you say something, because they know it's coming from a credible source.
Well, you know what? You hit on a really, really important point, and I'm glad you brought this up kind of early on so we can talk about it. I'm a firm believer, whether we're talking about something medical or something tactical, I believe I call it the two levels up principle. Is anytime you're going to teach something, generally you should kind of be two levels up from whatever it is that you're teaching in order to have total mastery in it. And I always advise people that are going to take a course, you should be taking a course from somebody who is two levels up from you. Because somebody who is at your level is going to have all the same questions that you have. Somebody who is one level up might have, you know, 50% of those questions answered. But somebody who's two levels up is going to be able to answer those really, really in-depth questions for you. And that's the way I feel. You know, I've been through advanced trauma life support, which is run by the American College of Surgeons. And I have got the highest marks every time I've ever done it, which they call instructor level. So I could take the instructor course, and even though I'm not a trauma surgeon, I could teach the course. And I don't do that simply because I think when it comes to hospital-based trauma, I think that's their lane. You know, if you're talking pre-hospital trauma, I feel very, very comfortable teaching that. You know, I've been a special forces medic. I've been a paramedic. I've deployed as an emergency medicine physician. I've worked out of an aid bag most of my life. So that's something I feel qualified to teach. But like you, when people come to me and they say, hey, you know, what about this? Like if somebody came to me and they said, unless if it was a very basic class and say EKG reading, I probably wouldn't teach it. I would probably defer to somebody else. I would probably say, hey, let me get Amumatu on the phone. You know, he's an expert on this. We'll get him over here to teach it or something like that.
Do you think that that's a common trait with instructors that you've found, that being able to take a step back and saying, you know what, I maybe don't know as much as I think I do, so I'm going to bring somebody in who does?
I think it's a common trait of the really good ones, in my opinion. And not to say that I am a really good instructor. I'm not trying to lump myself in with them, but that was what I learned from the good instructors that I saw. You know, for when I was going through the Q course, when I was going through as a, you know, I'll start it, you know, with the very beginning, when I was going through the first MOS phase, you know, to be a demolition sergeant, to be an 18 Charlie. And I was knowing that I would graduate and I would go to an ODA as the junior engineer on that team. So it wouldn't have made sense for other junior engineers to be, you know, teaching that course, you know, brand new staff sergeants to be teaching that course. And there weren't most of the cadre that were teaching it, not only had been junior Charlies and then senior Charlies, most of them had gone on to be the 18 Fox on the team, the intelligence sergeant, and or some of which had even served tours as team sergeant. So these were guys who were well-versed and had the broader picture. They not only knew the individual and, you know, minutia tasks of exactly how you prep that cutting charge or prep that breaching charge, but they knew the larger scale. You know, this is how you plan for a large-scale demolition takedown of a bridge, and this is how that fits into the larger scope of the commander's intent. You know, they'd seen it at a higher level. And you know, you never want to be, when you're up there at the podium, you never want to question down and get back to you. You know, what, you know, one or two times, hey, let me look it up during the break, you know, that's fine. But if you're constantly having to say, I don't know, I'm gonna have to reference something. And to me, and I even saw this in medical school, it's a shame that you think of a PhD doing this, but I saw a PhD who, no matter what question you ask this PhD, they'd say, well, it's in the book. It's in your textbook. And to me, that's just not the right answer.
Yeah, that's frustrating for sure. I specifically remember a time back when I was taking universities. It's like a 200 level course, nothing major, but we had a grad student teaching the course, and they were rifling off stuff that was not only incorrect and outdated, but it just way back. And I put my hand up. I was like, excuse me, which apparently you don't do because you get called into the dean's office pretty quick.
Yeah.
But it's like, I'm paying for this, that there's something wrong, right?
Yeah.
I 100% agree with you. You brought up a few things there. And one of the things that I really, really wanted to get into was I wanted to get into your thoughts about tactical EMS, because I know that's something that you specialize in and it's applicable to everybody listening to this podcast right now. So I want to kind of get your thoughts on the state of tactical EMS right now. And then I'll probably have a few more direct questions for you when it comes to things like TCCCs, field first aid and stuff like that. So what are your thoughts right now on the state of tactical EMS?
That's a tricky question. And I'm going to tell you why it's a tricky question, in my opinion, is tactical EMS means totally different things to different people. And I say that applies regionally. You know, if I say tactical EMS in a certain room full of people in Baltimore, Maryland, that means one thing. If I say it in San Diego, California, that means another thing. If I say that to paramedics, it means one thing. If I say it to physicians, it means another thing. If I say it to SWAT commanders, it means another thing. If I say it to FEMA or the head of municipalities in different places, it means different things. And that's part of the problem. And I've been asked this actually very recently, you know, is, well, who governs this? Mm-hmm. And the answer is everybody and nobody. So that's why it means different things. I mean, generally, we all think of it as meaning exactly what it does mean, which is you have units that are engaged in tactical operations, and tactical operations should require no explanation. I'm sure it doesn't to your listeners. And there is someone providing medical support to that. But there are so many different ways to skin that cat. And the way it was described to me, and I some people listening might disagree with this, but it kind of depends on whether your plan was born out of striving to be organic to police, or whether it was born trying to be organic to fire. That's kind of the simplest way to say that where the two different paths kind of are, and that's not completely black and white. But it's tricky. And the first time that I was ever introduced to it was actually I was brand new as a special forces medic. I'd just gotten back from, you know, going over and cross training and went back to my old battalion and went on a trip to train San Diego SWAT, which at the time didn't call themselves San Diego SWAT. They called themselves San Diego SRT. I think they might have changed back at some point. I'm not 100% sure, but we were training them, and specifically training them in case they were going to go up against anybody that might deploy some type of IEDs and some type of barricaded scenario. And they had tactical EMS with them. And this was such an unusual thing that they actually have. These weren't guys who they didn't wear San Diego PD uniforms. They didn't wear San Diego fire uniforms. They were their EMS at the time, and I'm dating myself because this was back in the 90s. Their EMS at the time was actually a contract company. So this contract civilian company did not have liability for their paramedics being armed, So they couldn't carry weapons of any kind. And it also affected a lot of what they were allowed. Basically, the company's insurance affected how they were going to be implemented as a resource. And that was in the 90s. Now, we've come a long way since then. But there's still a lot of different ways to skin the cat. And it's looked at in a lot of different ways. Some people look at tactical EMS as being integral. They wear the same badge as the police officers. They're armed at all times. They are sworn officers. Others take it away completely, keep it completely under fire or completely under EMS. Some places there's kind of a hybrid of the two. So it's different in a lot of different places. And I think the key, without getting too long-winded here, which I've probably already done, the key challenge in the years ahead is putting everybody on the same sheet of music, regardless of how they're skinning that cat, putting them on the same sheet of music as to what are the realistic threats that are going to be faced and how do those threats need to be addressed. And I think there's a way to do that, irrespective of what format people are using, whether they're arming their paramedics or not. And that's a hot button issue we can talk all day on. I have my own opinions on it. But I think there are workarounds and there are work throughs. I think work throughs are always better. But I don't think any two departments, I don't think you'd be challenged to get two departments in the same state to adopt the same format. So trying to get at something nationwide, I think, is going to be even more challenging.
Yeah. On that note of standardization, my understanding is that there are programs and there is kind of a doctrine out there that is somewhat widespread and adopted and agreed to by the majority of people. And those are programs like TCCC. Who heads those what organizations are those right now, in your opinion, kind of leading the charge, and where is that going?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned TCCC, and TCCC obviously that's pretty much the gold standard. And it does lead the charge. Surprisingly, I've discovered, recently I was at the Thor conference in Norway, and which is an international conference. I'm trying to remember, trauma, hemorrhage, oxygenation, resuscitation, I think is what they just wanted it to spell Thor because it's in Norway for obvious reasons. But surprisingly, TCCC, the TCCC ball has been kind of picked up and carried by civilian agencies internationally, I think at a higher rate of penetration than it has here nationally. Now here nationally, we also have the Committee on Tactical Emergency Casualty Care, CTECC, which is kind of the civilian counterpart. And I work in an advisory. I don't say work. Obviously I don't get a paycheck. I'm considered in an advisory capacity for them. I'm not a board member. I don't get to vote on any policy or anything like that. But I've attended a couple of their meetings, and I think they recognized that I brought something to the table, and that I was a voice that could be heard, which I really appreciate, because when you're in that room with guys like Reed Smith and Josh Bobko, and Mike Schurz, you look around the room and you're like, wow, these are the thought leaders when it comes to tactical casualty care in the civilian setting. And they're the proponent. But it's not that simple. I mean, just being the proponency is not that simple, because there is no federal law that says, okay, in Waco, Texas, the whatever you're doing for tactical EMS in Waco, Texas must fall into lockstep with the guidelines that TECC puts down. There's no federal law governing that. There's nothing, at state levels, at federal levels, that would dictate that. So although these are guidelines, I mean, at the end of the day, they're suggestions, they're best practice guidelines, which I think, somebody's out there listening to this and they say, well, where do I look to know what I should be doing? That is where you should look to know what you should be doing. But again, this is not something where, like the Joint Commission in hospitals, where people from TEC to come and inspect your training and inspect your logbooks and your credentials and make sure you're adhering to the standard, because they don't have that kind of power, nor do they have that kind of manpower.
Yeah, I find it really interesting that, because in my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but in my understanding that, say, for emergency medicine, there is kind of a guideline and a checklist that comes in with trauma, or say somebody comes in with a gunshot wound. From what I remember working in a hospital was that there was kind of a almost like a checklist
for
the team to follow to make sure that nothing was ever missed. Those are people that have been doing it. They're emergency medical experts. They've been doing it for years and they do it every day, yet they still follow a checklist. Why isn't something like that taken and put into something for EMS and things like that? Like, am I missing something?
I think I can give you kind of the short answer to that. The short answer would be, so in order for me to have a hospital that has a functioning emergency room, right? And not every hospital necessarily has an emergency room. And then you have different levels of emergency rooms. Like there's trauma designations, right? So a level one trauma center means we take everything. So that's, I trained at a level one trauma center. So that's every gunshot, every vehicle rollover, every burn, dismemberment, whatever you can possibly imagine, it's going to the level one trauma center. And then the designations kind of go down from there. To have and maintain any of those trauma designations, you have to be approved by the American College of Surgeons. And the checklist that you described, the format by which they kind of provide quality assurance, is called Advanced Trauma Life Support, ATLS. And ATLS was designed way back. So as an emergency medicine physician, I don't have to requalify an ATLS. I did it twice as an 18 Delta Special Forces medic. I did it once as a med student right before graduation. As a board certified emergency medicine physician, the American College of Surgeons has recognized the level of training that I have, and they say I don't ever have to do it again as long as I maintain my board certification. What ATLS was designed for is that little tiny emergency room that you drive by out in the country that is manned on a 12 or 24 hour shift by that local country doctor that might be an old school general practitioner, might be an internal medicine doctor, might be a family medicine doctor. If that emergency room that you're looking at is authorized to receive ambulances with trauma at any level, they have to be a graduate of ATLS, and they have to have a current ATLS certificate. And they're going to follow that checklist that you described to the letter, because that's how they've been taught to do trauma. Don't veer from that. You're going to maintain it that way. Now, when you're talking about tactical EMS, when you're talking about SWAT teams and TEMS teams, there's nobody saying to them, you will do a primary survey in the field using the MARCH algorithm or using the XABC algorithm or using the REACT algorithm, mnemonic, which is what I used to teach in my course. There's nobody dictating that. You know, it's by and large, people are using mnemonics or algorithmic approaches that are pretty close to one another, whether that's the XABC or the MARCH, which is what TCCC uses. But there's nobody to stand over them and say, if you're going to treat trauma in the field, you will treat it this way, period. And there might be somebody listening who disagree with me. If NAEMT is saying something different, and they might be, but I've worked with multiple organizations and I've heard multiple different reasons why they choose to do it a slightly different way. And, you know, a lot of people have adopted the MARCH mnemonic as the way to do it, which is what TTRI-C teaches. But not everybody. You know, some people are old school and they're like, well, it's XABC is almost the same, so I just do it that way. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because I mean, I'm familiar with MARCH, the TCCC, and when I originally thought of tactical EMS, that's where my head goes, because it goes, okay, first is care under fire, so if I'm in contact, it's return fire. You know what I mean? Like, so anybody who's come from the military background, that's step one, And then you get into, okay, now I'm into the tactical field care portion, which is March. And then you get into your evacuation phase.
Right.
But something that kind of queued up when you were talking about your time dealing with the civilian agencies, I believe there's probably an inherent difference between, like you said, the military perspective and maybe even policing perspective of what TCCC is and what a civilian or an EMS or fire would think of it as. And it could be something as simple as in theater, you're looking at more things like shrapnel and blast injuries and to extremities because of body armor.
Yes.
When you're talking about it in a civilian aspect or in the US or in Canada or in any other modern country, you're looking more so at torso injuries. So either gunshot wounds, things like that. So am I kind of on the right page there? What are you?
No, you're 100% on the right page. The wounding pattern is different. This multiple studies have been done on that to show that the wounding pattern is different. And at the most recent TECC meeting, actually we discussed that again with the latest data that's out there. And you're 100% correct for obvious reasons. Body armor probably being the biggest factor. Also, another thing that comes into play is those chest and torso injuries tend to be a lot more survivable in the civilian world because they tend to be a little bit more low velocity, right? So let's say I'm out with a bunch of Rangers one night and we hit a target. And of course, when the smoke clears, we're treating everybody, right? Well, any bad guys who didn't have body armor on, who got shot center chest by a Ranger with 5.56, they're not treatable because they died as soon as they got hit. In these civilian instances, we're not seeing that. You know, it's a 9mm. It's not, typically not dead center in the 10 ring. So they tend to be a lot more survivable for that reason. So there's multiple things that contribute to that, in my opinion. And I think most people that have looked at the data would agree with me. Here's my thought on that, though, is I still think that March is best. I still think that addressing massive hemorrhage first is the best answer. And the reason I say that is somebody with an arterial injury to an extremity, if they have a brachial artery injury, a femoral artery injury, they could die in 3 to 4 minutes. Maybe even under 3 minutes. If they're amped up, their heart rate is high, it could be less, technically it could be less than 3 minutes. It only takes me 30 seconds to put that tourniquet on. And that's also something that is 100% treatable in the field. Now let's take the guy who was shot in the chest. A tension pneumothorax is usually not going to kill somebody in that same 3 to 4 minute time period. If they're dying in that 3 to 4 minute time period, it's because they had an injury to the heart or an injury to the central vasculature that was not compatible with life anyway. And also, whether I put a chest seal on that or not, that may not be a survival. I mean, that's literally putting on a chest seal and usually decompressing the chest are kind of the only things that most people are going to do in the field. I mean, get a little bit higher than that, we're talking about doing chest tubes or finger thoracostomies, whatever it might be. But, typically if that is an injury that's going to die quickly, then it probably was not a survivable injury to begin with. And I don't have a complete chest set in the field with me, right? I can't crack the chest and cross clamp the aorta or whatever it might be. So the reason I think to circle back around, the reason I think March is still, in my opinion, the way to go is because it addresses things that can kill you in 3 to 4 minutes with something you can 100% do to stop that death in that time period. As opposed to if we tried to rewrite it for civilians and say, well, you're getting more chest injuries, so we're going to have you treat the chest first. Well, then they might die from bleeding from that easily treatable extremity injury while I'm treating the chest injury. And for obvious reasons, that's not what we want to happen.
Thank you for explaining that. I think that was a fantastic way to kind of summarize all of that. But it brought up so many different, I was making notes as you were talking.
Am I giving too long answers?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Okay. Cause I will ramble.
one of the things to kind of set you up here. One of the things that I want to talk about for sure is tourniquets, because I know you have some thoughts on that. But the other one was, anybody listening to the podcast who are in the field that could potentially be involved with a responsive incident where they're possibly under fire, or maybe something where there is immediate danger. Now, it doesn't have to necessarily be an enemy combatant. It could be environmental. Mm-hmm. Where would you say, and obviously just your opinion, on drawing the line at care in the field versus evac and moving to a more advanced care location?
I always say, no matter what phase of care you're in, whether that's care under fire, tactical field care, prolonged field care, care in transit, whatever it might be, you should only address injuries that are going to kill them before that next phase. So obviously, if I had to drag somebody across, you know, X number of feet of open ground, there is the potential, and there they have a spurting femoral bleed. Obviously, there's the potential that that could kill them before I get them to cover, and I don't want that to happen. So that has to be addressed, whether it's with direct pressure, you know, grabbing a hold of that thing and using that as one of your lifting points, or if it's with a tourniquet. You know, there's this, depending on who you talk to, you know, one school of thought is a tourniquet is the only thing that ever happens in care under fire. And I would say that that's true, that that's the highest level of care in care under fire. Okay. Unless you're down behind a wall or, you know, behind a vehicle, the firefight might still be going on, but then, you know, you're behind cover. So you can maybe do a little bit more. Maybe you can apply a chest seal, decompress a chest, something of that nature. But by and large, I mean, there's only two things that you should be doing. The first thing you should always be doing under fire is returning fire. Because if somebody's still shooting at you, it's not time to provide medical care at all. If it's environmental or a potential threat, i.e. you think, you know, that's, hey, this guy happened to get wounded right next to the backpack that the shooter was carrying, and there's pipes sticking out of it, pipes and wires. That's obviously not someplace I want to treat somebody. So I need to identify where I want to go with that person. And then anything I have to do to keep them alive for that 30 to 50 feet, I'm going to do, but no more. And that's, to me, that's in junior medics and people that have not been under fire while they provided care. That's the biggest hole that I see in the game, is people want to stay and play too much. And I think it's less is more, because it's treating what you can to get them to that next level and then providing more care, I think is the right answer 90% of the time.
Yeah. And I think, and self-care also kind of comes with that as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, it's great you brought that up too, because the potential for self-care in the civilian setting, you know, especially we're talking about law enforcement, civilians obviously as well, but especially law enforcement officers, because they're a little bit more likely to be carrying an IFAC. The potential for self-care is higher because, again, we're talking about mostly low velocity stuff, right? So, you know, unlike getting shot by an AK round that might have just spun me around on my axis, and I'm just, or getting hit by an IED, guys that I've talked to, and I've interviewed guys on my podcast who are hit by IEDs, and, you know, them talking about their state of mind, like literally not knowing, am I alive? Am I dead? What's that voice I hear? Oh, that's my voice. I mean, literally having no idea. So, one of the guys I interviewed, a guy, just a great guy by the name of Bobby Dove. He, as he was losing consciousness, was telling the weapons guy on his team, he just kept repeating tourniquet, tourniquet, tourniquet as he passed. But if you think of this from a law enforcement or civilian point of view, it's probably going to be a knife or a low velocity. So you're a lot more likely to have the ability to do that self-care. And I don't know if you've seen that video of there's a high-risk stop was conducted on the highway, and they get out and one of the officers gets shot, takes one in the arm. And he immediately, the other officers kind of close in and get in front of him to provide care, to provide fire rather. And he's whipping out his own tourniquet and getting it on. And one of the other officers runs over just really briefly to kind of help him out with the tourniquet. But that potential is there and it's real and it's something that needs to be practiced 100%.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts? So two things, because I want to finish up the thought of with the TCCC, and then I want to get into the IFAC stuff. What are your thoughts about unneeded, or not unneeded, but unnecessary equipment that people are bringing out into the field?
Drives me absolutely crazy, man.
And to preface that for people, I'm not talking about the extra kit on your weapon system. I'm talking more about things like monitors, O2 tanks, and things like that. So I'll let you.
Yeah. So have you heard my O2 tank spiel? Have you heard that?
I have. I kind of binged on your content.
Okay. So yeah, I know I've said that before. I didn't know if you'd heard it or not. So yeah, to me, if you are carrying O2 tanks into a firefight, you are voluntarily running towards the enemy with explosives. I mean, that's really the best way to put it. And here's the fact of the matter. So, and this came up at the Thor conference, something that I've been saying for years. So definitive airway management and a lot of these trauma cases is an exceedingly low priority, and people are gnashing their teeth while I say that. But the fact of the matter is, if when you're talking about a multi-system trauma patient who's hypovolemic, if you perform an endotracheal intubation on that patient, you're actually taking away all their preload. And we had some excellent data at the Thor conference this year that showed basically entire cohorts of patients that compensated for their shock very, very, very well up to the point that they got intubated and then they immediately crashed because all their preload was taken away. In my opinion, and I've racked my brain back and forth on this, I don't think there's ever any indication until you're in a vehicle, until you're in an ambulance or on a helicopter, to give oxygen to a ballistic trauma patient. That's my opinion. Is I don't think the juice is worth the squeeze, number one. I don't think, you know, putting an oxygen mask on somebody in the ambulance or in the aircraft, that's great. Okay, putting them on them at the scene, I mean, yeah, if they're already, you know, they're already having some issues with oxygen carrying capacity. So, okay, so the last 6 red blood cells they got left, you're going to maximally saturate them. Hey, good for you. But to what end? You know, we have a saying in medicine or there's a thing in medicine called the number needed to treat, right? So how many people with a cough and a fever do I have to give a Z-Pak to before I really treated a pneumonia? That number is relatively low. Okay. So it's acceptable. That's why you see Z-Paks. They still get given out too much, but that's why Z-Paks get given out the way they do, because the number needed to treat is a pretty low number. The number needed to treat to carry oxygen into a firefight is astronomical. Like the one or two patients you would actually help, because, you know, just saturating again, those last 6 red blood cells was what kept their brain alive. Astronomically low typically. And if you look at all those, you always see these big pie charts of, you know, what kills people in these ballistic trauma incidents, whether we're talking about the global war on terror or civilian, and you see this little narrow sliver that's airway, right? If you dissect that narrow sliver a little bit farther, that's not people who are failing to control their airway. That's usually they had maybe a grazing wound to the neck, maybe took out some of their great vessels. They've got an expanding hematoma, and they really needed to get criked, or they've got a facial or a jaw injury, so they needed to get criked. But even in those instances, what they need is they need that crike, or, you know, they need that definitive airway, but oftentimes their respiratory drive is still there. So, you know, you paralyzing them and sedating them and taking over their airway and hooking them up to oxygen, you're not really doing them any favors, because you took away their preload, which is probably going to kill them. You carried an explosive device into a firefight to do it, which was a dumb thing to begin with. And the fact of the matter is, if somebody stops breathing because of penetrating trauma, that's usually that's indicative of, you need to vent their chest, first of all, to make sure it's not that they can't breathe because of bilateral pneumothoraces. It's usually not an airway issue. And it's usually not, I'm going to breathe for him and I'm going to get this guy through it. This isn't somebody in cardiac arrest. This is somebody who had penetrating trauma. So oftentimes, those are actually dead people.
So just to clarify for myself, just to make sure that I'm not missing something here, when you talk preload, my understanding, just from your explanation, is that the human body is amazing at keeping itself alive.
Yes.
And it reacts in ways that we don't even think about in order to keep us alive. So what you're saying with the preload is that when you either you do some type of trach tube or anything and then administer assisted breathing, you're giving the body permission to be like, oh, okay, somebody else has got it. I'm going to step back.
Not exactly. So yeah. So what happens is the way we breathe is we produce negative pressure inside of our chest, right? We pull the diaphragm down. That creates negative pressure, right? And nature abhors a vacuum. So what happens is the air at whatever air pressure you're currently at rushes into your lungs to expand them, because the lungs don't expand on their own. They're just bags. So the diaphragm creates that negative pressure, creates a vacuum, sucks air into the chest. The moment I stick a tube down your throat and I start breathing for you, this is now positive pressure ventilation. So every time that ventilator pushes air in, or every time that bag valve mask pushes air in, that's positive pressure going into your chest. That positive pressure, oftentimes in a patient that has already bled out a lot of their volume, that positive pressure is going to exceed the pressure in the superior and inferior vena cava that are bringing blood back to the heart. So if, as I squeeze that bag valve mask, picture this in your mind, I squeeze that bag valve mask, and as I do so, the pressure in your chest goes up, the vena cava collapses, so no blood gets back to the heart. And that's what I mean when I say I've eliminated your preload. And you can see this happen. There's, if you look for it, I believe there's some pretty good videos of this actually happening where they did it under fluoroscopy, and they showed as they put positive pressure ventilation into the chest, the vena cava completely collapses. Basically, your heart is still beating, but it's empty. And if you don't have preload, then you don't have afterload. You don't have anything coming out the other side.
That makes a lot of sense, actually, the way that you explain it. Something I would have never thought of, of course we know that all our systems are kind of interconnected in one way or the other, but you wouldn't think necessarily that by adding air, which most people think is what that person is going to need to stay alive, you're actually stopping the blood flow, which is the thing that is going to keep them alive. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's a little counterintuitive even to what I thought, or even to what I was taught in the early days of medicine. But now, and again, this kind of reflects back to that whole two levels up thing, right? Is something that, you know, I was taught to intubate as an 18 Delta, and I was taught that multi-system trauma patients all get intubated in the field. And I, in training, you know, whether we were doing it on live tissue or mannequins or whatever it was, that patient got intubated. And knowing what I know now, also knowing from experience after seeing all these trauma patients, how many of them are awake, alert, and yes, in pain, but still protecting their airway. It's a beehive you don't want to poke at.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's kind of goes back to what we were talking about earlier, though. It's unless you have the time in the field and the experience, or the instructor that is teaching you has that experience, you're just going to get the stuff that's been passed along from, you know, to instructor, and that's kind of where the innovation kind of not necessarily stops, but hits a plateau, right? Until something happens. I mean, we saw the same thing with firearms training with the military, right? You can go back, you know, operant conditioning and all those types of things. It's until something happens that's usually not good that we go back and realize, oh shit, what did we do? What happened? And now we make the change.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely right. That's the same. Absolutely right.
That's, in my understanding, is that's how trauma care not just for military or emergency medicine. That's how it always advances. This is a slow roll, is my understanding.
It is. And it's when I went through training, we were still, and some places are still clinging to this. You know, it used to be every trauma patient got 2 liters of crystalloid fluid. So they got 2 liters of either lactated ringers or normal saline. And at the time, this got very misconstrued over time, because actually that was originally something that people came up with as a diagnostic tool. And basically, if you came in to me, you were my trauma patient, and your blood pressure was below 100 and your heart rate was above normal, you know, say your heart rate was in the 110s, 120s, and I gave you 2 liters of fluid, and that seemed to kind of take care of it and manage it, I knew you were in a very, very early stage of shock. And if it took care of it transiently, I could estimate by how long transiently it addressed it, what stage of shock you were in. And if it didn't touch it at all, I knew you were in a much later stage of shock. So it was only really a diagnostic tool. And I'm fudging a little bit on how I'm describing it. And if anybody wants to call me to the carpet, I recognize that. But over time, people started to think it was a treatment. So people were even teaching in battlefield medicine, where, you know, at the time we, you know, nowhere near blood. It was a question you really didn't even need answered, other than the fact that the guy's got holes in him and he's in some level of shock. And what we found out over time was those 2 liters of crystalloid fluid, they thin out your clotting factors. They dilute the red blood cells that you have remaining carrying oxygen. And because they are basically at ambient room temperature, they cool the body even more, which feeds into that lethal triad of hypothermia, acidosis, and decreased coagulation of the blood. So they were actually making people sicker. So we've gone way 180 degrees from that. You know, when I first started as a medic, I was carrying liter bags of fluid. And by the time I did my last trip in the war on terror, I was carrying 250 cc bags of fluid, and I was primarily only carrying them so if I needed to do some type of field anesthesia, you know, or field sedation, I was trying not to put people down all the way, not to use, and also as a gateway so I could start my blood, not as a resuscitative tool and not as a diagnostic tool. So we've come a long way, but like you say, some places and some organizations are go kicking and screaming into that next level.
On all these topics that we've just talked about, you have episodes out that go much more in depth on Mind of the Warrior. So what I'm going to do here on ours as well is I'm going to link those for everybody to listen to. So if you want a little bit more of an in-depth look at what we've just talked about, you can check those out on Mind of the Warrior podcast. All right, everybody, thank you so much for checking out the first half of my interview with Dr. Mike Simpson. To catch the second half, which will be coming out in the next day or two, make sure to hit subscribe on your favorite podcast player, and you'll be the first to get a chance to listen to it. If you haven't already, make sure to check us out at thebreakdown.ca. We are giving away a gear bag full of equipment for those of you who subscribe to the podcast. It's completely free, so make sure to jump on and do that today. Share it with your friends and colleagues. And I look forward to continually bringing you guys this content. I look forward to launching the second half of this interview with Doc. You guys are really going to enjoy it. And coming up on the podcast, we have amazing guests, people like Tony Blauer, Jay Dobbins, and so many more. So I hope you guys are enjoying the content. Have a great rest of your shift, and make sure to stay safe.